It's my pleasure to introduce to you our last speaker for the morning, Jeremy Jackson. Many years ago, Stephen Jay Gould told me the following story, which I don't think is apocryphal, but I wouldn't stake my life on it. Steve was in the Deep South discussing creationism and other issues with various Christian leaders on the topic of whether or not U.S. public schools should be teaching foreign language to American children. One of these Christian leaders was particularly adamant. He argued that we should not teach foreign language on the grounds that, quote, if English was good enough for Jesus, it's good enough for us. Now, I realize I'm sort of backing into my introduction to Jeremy here, but I thought you'd appreciate the story. And I think it has two morals. One, that we have a long road ahead of us in the battle against ignorance. And two, that when you make judgments and recommendations based on your perception of history, you'd better make sure you're using an appropriate baseline. This idea, the notion of baselines and how they can shift over time, how things might seem normal and therefore acceptable, but in fact are neither, is one of the important themes in Jeremy's recent work on marine conservation. So Jeremy Jackson is the Ritter Professor of Oceanography and Director of the Center for Marine Biodiversity and Conservation at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography in La Jolla, California. And he's a Senior Scientist Emeritus at the Smithsonian Institution. It's hard to characterize Jeremy's work in one term because he has done really important and truly influential work in several different areas, in paleobiology, in paleoecology, in evolution, in marine ecology, in conservation biology. He's worked on the details of bryozoan evolution. He's been a field geologist, a field ecologist. He's worked on ecosystem analysis on a very broad scale. Jeremy's first four peer-reviewed papers came out while he was still a graduate student, and all of them, take note, graduate students, all of them appeared in the journal Science. There was no looking back from those auspicious beginnings. Jeremy is the author of many, many scientific publications and several books. He has a new book coming out later this year called Shifting Baselines in Fisheries, Using the Past to Manage the Future. He's been the recipient of numerous awards and medals just in the last couple of years. Jeremy has been awarded the International Award for Research in Ecology and Conservation by Conservation Biology of the BBVA Foundation in Madrid. He was the winner of the Edward Leroux Memorial Award for Outstanding Contributions to Conservation Biology of the Society for Conservation Biology. And more recently, he won at Harvard University the Roger Cory Peterson Medal, which he shares with other recent recipients, including E.O. Wilson, Jared Diamond, Paul Ehrlich, and Jane Goodall. So, and as Patricia said, et cetera. So I think Jeremy fits what David said earlier this morning about Darwin. He's a deep thinker, he's an effective communicator, and he's a very careful observer, three qualities that scientists all aspire to, but not all of us reach in at such a level that Jeremy has. So we are really, really pleased and proud to have Jeremy here today.
That was the nicest introduction I've had in a long time. Thank you. That was really lovely. I really don't know why I'm here. This is a birthday party, and I'm a party pooper. I mean, I did used to study evolution. I loved studying speciation and bryozoans. I'm very proud of the work I did. And it was a lot of fun, and Dana and I really got to know each other on a really terrific paleontological expedition in northwestern Panama, schlepping around on the worst research vessel you've ever seen in your life. But then, about that time, I woke up and I realized that everything I'd ever studied as a marine ecologist was either gone completely or had changed so much that it was almost unrecognizable. And like Patricia, I got very emotional about that. And it sort of changed my life. As you'll see from this talk, in a few centuries, we have, in fact, managed to reverse a very large proportion of 500 million years of evolution. And we are doing our very best in the ocean to return to the Precambrian jellyfish and bacteria. That's what a dead zone is. I'll talk about those in a minute. Now, I've read most of Darwin's books. I certainly haven't been a Darwin scholar. It's something I'd love to do. But I think I can say safely that it never, ever occurred to Darwin that he was not studying pristine nature. It never occurred to him to ask the question, how, in some way or another, is what I'm doing, what I'm observing, in some fundamental way, in some deep biological way, altered because of what people do. You know, his contemporaries got it. I'll show you a quote from Jules Verne. H.G. Wells in The Time Machine a little bit later got it very, very clearly. But Darwin was sort of oblivious out there in Downhouse. I mean, everybody knew that that English countryside was God's nature. Anyway, he just didn't talk about it. I think it's fair to say that Darwin suffered from an extreme case of what we call the shifting baseline syndrome. It's a very dangerous disease that affects almost all advanced peoples in almost all advanced societies. And basically, what it means is that we all think that natural, that nature, is the way the world was when we were children, and unnatural is the way the world deteriorated during our lifetimes, which is why I'm a lot more depressing than Dana's daughter. But it's also true that children don't exactly listen to their parents, and so they, generation by generation, repeat the same mistake. And as Bill McKibben has very eloquently pointed out, not only is nature dead, but we do not have a clue of what nature was, because it has changed so profoundly long before we were born that it's just almost unapproachable. So with that cheerful beginning, and I think we're going to need the lights because I study things underwater. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, and they're gloomy. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to talk about the ocean, which I love and which I know a lot more about than the land, but I mean, it's just as cheerful on the land as it is in the ocean. Think about that photograph. We'll come back to that photograph. I'd like to start with this. I'll bet you in this room, if I ask, how many of you have read Silent Spring? Yeah, I'm in Madison, Wisconsin, you know. You ask that question at a corporate meeting, which is the kind of audience I really like to talk to, because you're believers, you know, and maybe one person will raise their hand. This book changed the world. The modern understanding of the folly of Homo sapiens was really defined by this book and my former colleague Dave Keeling's observations of the concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, the two events that really told us that nature had croaked and that it would never, ever, ever be put back in the bottle again. And Rachel Carson, as you all know, was a beautiful writer. And she had a conflict in her life about whether or not she was going to write fiction or poetry or be a scientist. And one could say, thank God, she sort of did both because her books moved the world. And she began, I don't know if you remember, she began Silent Spring with what she called a fable for tomorrow, in which she describes what it must look like around here when it's not all white and gray, you know, with dairy cows and milk and apple pie and how wonderful it was. And then, you know, this mysterious maladies come and everywhere there's a shadow of death and it's really creepy. And then she backs off and she says, I fibbed a little bit. You know, there is no one place where all these things have happened together, but all of these things have happened, and if we don't get our act together, they will all happen together in different places, and it's going to be the apocalypse, right? That's what Silent Spring is about. Well, I can tell you a story for today about an estuary with beautiful, clear water full of all the animals we love and love to eat and love to enjoy and love to swim and all the rest of it. And then a blight comes to that bay and the water's dirty and it stinks. I mean, Lake Erie achieved this since, I mean, this is weird giving this talk in Wisconsin, but just think about the Great Lakes in their glory of the 1950s and you get the idea. And everything that we value in that estuary disappears, and everything that we don't value in that estuary appears. There's no oxygen, the water stinks, it's full of microbes, cholera, you name it, people get sick, and it's just truly disgusting, one of the primal emotions I learned. And the difference between my story and Rachel Carson's story is my story is a description of every single large estuary in the world, 100%. Okay? Now, Rachel Carson asked three simple questions. And the whole book is three questions. It's beautiful. What's going on now that's new, different, and scary? Second question, what's going to happen if we don't stop doing it? And the third is, how can we stop doing it? That's Silent Spring. So that's what we have to do. We have to ask, what's going on in the oceans that is new, different, and scary? What are the oceans going to be like if we don't change our ways? And what do we have to do to change them? Boy, that's the really depressing part. So the three drivers of ocean change, as far as I'm concerned, are overfishing, exploitation, pollution, and climate change. And I'm going to go through these in sequence. My wife calls this the refinement of the obituary of nature. And that's more or less what it is. Cod was the second most valuable natural commodity in the world for two centuries. At least two world wars were fought about cod. In its heyday, cod were a little less than 2 yards long on average. We can confirm that from the vertebrae in archaeological sites, and you can see that long before they disappeared, this is a time series of how many fish caught before, whatever, the recruitment, the resource capital was going down, the fishing mortality was going up, and you can see just before the Canadian government nuked the cod, fishing mortality was approaching 100%, and in their wisdom, they said, keep at it, boys. And a guy named Ram Myers, who's one of my heroes, said, no, don't do that. And so they fired Ram. And they went out and fished, and 35,000 people lost their jobs. And the cod has never come back. And as far as we can tell, it may never come back. Think about that curve, because we're going to see something like it. Now, these data come from the great Daniel Pauly's lab, Billy Christensen in charge of it. Red is good, pale blue is bad. Red means that you could walk from Labrador to England on the backs of cod. Pale blue means you drown. That's the way it was in 1900. That's the way it is today. And that's not subtle, right? You don't need statistics. 1900, today, the European Union, in its wisdom, sees great deep color surrounding Britain and northern France and feels it is premature to put stiffer regulations on the fishing of cod. They actually made W look like an enlightened environmentalist. These are data of a student of mine, Lauren McClenahan, who spent 2.5 years in archives and libraries all over the world, looking at old pirate logs and things like that to figure out how many green turtles there were. Those big green circles that are based on a hell of a lot of hunting data signify 5 to 6 million 1,000-pound animals. The number we come up with is 91 million. There have to be more than 50 million. There were certainly possibly 150 million. That's more biomass than all the bison in North America before the horse and the rifle, and that is more biomass than the mammals in Africa today. All of Africa. That's a lot of turtles. They ate turtle grass. The great Audubon describes turtle grass as looking almost like a golf course, this high, bright green. Today it grows this high and the tips are rotten. Turtle grass gets a wasting disease that kills the beds, all because there's no more lawnmower. It was called green turtles. This is the way it is today. Those big yellow circles represent 500 individuals. There are way fewer than a few hundred thousand green turtles in the Caribbean today. That's about 99.7% reduction in that time. And you know, this is not news except to scientists. Lewis Carroll got it. You remember the mock turtle? Once said the mock turtle with a sigh, "I was a real turtle," instead of a fake turtle with the head of a calf and the feet of the calf, because you had to pretend to serve turtle soup, but there weren't any more turtles, so you got a calf's head and you made turtle soup. I mean, that was popular literature. Yeah, in 1865. I think Julia Baum gave a talk here a couple of days ago. This is one of Julia's quite remarkable studies. For 14 years, in the entire Western Atlantic, we have reduced sharks from 40% to 89% of their abundance in 1986, which was probably 3 or 5% of their abundance in 1900. Sharks are going, going, gone. And these amazing pictures come from Lauren again, the woman who did the study of the turtles. This is coming out in this month's Conservation Biology. Lauren discovered these pictures in newspaper archives. They were taken mostly by the same photographer on the same dock in Key West, fish that were caught on single afternoon cruises on the same boat over 50 years. And these are the trophy fish. It's a ritual they do every day, the biggest fish caught on the boat. That's 1956. That's 1974. That's 2007. And they pay in you know, 1956 dollars, twice as much to catch that as they used to pay to catch the other stuff. And I just love that bubba there. Look at that big fish, man. And you try to get sports fishermen in the Florida Keys to admit that there might be a problem, they will all tell you that the Keys are full of fish and the environmentalists are assholes. So. And they hang the head of the Florida Keys Marine Sanctuary in effigy on a regular basis and give him threatening phone calls. This is your U.S. National Marine Fisheries Service 2007 report. They are responsible legally for the well-being of 528 stocks of fish. That sometimes means species, or when they can't tell them apart, it means a bunch of similar species. 54% of those stocks for which they're legally responsible, they do not have a clue, i.e. they do not have any data to know whether those stocks are in good shape or not. That, they say that on their website. I'm not saying that. Of the remaining stocks, 17% are subject to overfishing. That means they haven't been legally declared overfished. 24% are overfished, and 61% are fully fished or not fished to capacity. That means that at best, 28% of all the fisheries that your government is responsible for managing are known to be in good shape, and all the rest of them are not by law. The title of that report is Another Great Year for U.S. Fisheries. And I don't know if you follow this, but Alaskan pollock. Alaskan pollock is the world's largest fishery. It's fish McNuggets. Okay? McDonald's really cares about Alaskan pollock. You can see that Alaskan pollock has been doing badly the last 5 years. This is female spawning biomass. Think about it as profit. And this line is maximum sustainable yield. And when you go below that, you're in trouble. This is the trend. These are real data. Last year they declined 50%. This is the model. This is the model that assumes that climate change is not important, that the other species in the ecosystem are not important. This is the model based on what we know about Alaskan pollock, which is a lot. On the basis of this curve and this model, it was declared that we can just continue to fish pollock because everything's good, because the model says it'll be fine. And the reason we don't have a lot of fish is because they all swam to Siberia because of climate change. It never occurred to anybody that they didn't swim to Siberia, there weren't any left, because have you ever seen, I should have a picture of a factory ship, I don't. So imagine going to a bank, especially today, but imagine going to a bank, and this is your profit and loss statement for the last 5 years, and you said, I've run a model, and depending on the psychological state of people in Madison, Wisconsin, in 3 years I'm gonna make a profit, so give me a lot of money. That's how we manage our fisheries. Okay, and it's not just that the fish disappear. There are all sorts of effects, and the most famous are what's called fishing down the food web, destruction of the seafloor by trawling, and trophic cascades. So this fishing down the food web, this is the great Daniel Pauly's, perhaps his greatest contribution. I mean, it's just the notion that, you know, we really like to eat big, tasty fish, like sharks and tuna, right? And swordfish, and they're the top, they're the king of the mountain, and they eat all the littler fish, they eat the littler fish, they eat the littler fish, they eat the littler fish. So we like to eat the apex predators of the ocean. And as we run out of apex predators, we fish down the food web. So globally, that's the global ocean, we have fished down the food web that much just since 1950. Trawling, we can see it from space. How to think about trawling. Imagine a locomotive that you attach to a huge train, a chain, and tie to some enormous boat and drag it across the bottom. Or imagine a horror movie with a huge, enormous helicopter with the locomotive attached to a chain, and it flies over Manhattan with a locomotive about, 200 feet above street level, and you could watch the skyscrapers. I realize that's a tacky metaphor since we all saw it, but that's basically trawling. And so on the left you see a deep sea coral reef before it got trawled once. And on the right you see what it looks like after it's been trawled once. And most of the fish we catch are bycatch, so what do? We throw them away. And that's all to get this, that's orange roughy, and if you eat orange roughy, that is a sin. I mean, you are destroying these, which are centuries old, to get those little fish that become reproductively mature when they're 50 years old. Guess how sustainable orange roughy is. And so think about this. Take all the forests that have ever been cut down by humanity in the history of humanity. That area is equivalent to the amount of seafloor that's been turned into a parking lot, and you can see the furrows, in a century. None of my geophysical colleagues can leave an instrument on the seafloor because it will be trawled. And the Gulf of Mexico is the equivalent, 200% of the area of the Gulf of Mexico is trawled every year. And so as a result, we used to have lots of big fish, and now we have sardines, and we used to have forests on the seafloor, and now we have mud. This trophic cascade thing, I apologize, this is sort of hard to see in this slide, but all the big sharks have decreased enormously. All the little sharks and rays they used to eat have increased enormously. And the consequence of that, oh, and then there's this one thing called a cow-nose ray. And so as a result, there are no more hammerhead sharks, therefore there's tons of rays, therefore there's no scallops left in the Chesapeake Bay, there's no scallops left in Pamlico Sound. About 60 million of these stingrays this big swim through Chesapeake Bay every year now. I did my master's thesis on the Chesapeake Bay. I used to swim in those environments, and I think I saw two in a year of diving. This is a rat or cockroach of the ocean. And I love this quote from Jules Verne. 1870, 11 years after The Origin of Species, when the seas have been depleted of whales and seals, we shall then have our waters cluttered with octopi, medusae, and squids, which will create hotbeds of infection in the absence of those huge mammals whose stomachs were intended by God to keep the oceans clean. Now, he sort of got the trophic ecology a little wrong, but he definitely got the idea. Pollution. Biological, introduced species are pollution. Poisoning food webs, rise of slime. You remember that Little Shop of Horrors? Some of you are old enough, you must have seen the movie, The Little Shop of Horrors. Steve Martin is the dentist, remember, he's really friendly. And the plant grows out all over and encompasses everything. This is the Little Shop of Horrors in the Mediterranean. It was introduced accidentally from the Monaco Aquarium. It's a beautiful green plant that people like in their aquaria. Nothing eats it. It's transforming benthic communities from 500 to 1,000 invertebrates to about 50. It is carpeting the entire northwestern Mediterranean. And there are thousands of examples like that, kudzu and fire ants on the land as well. Poison webs. I'll only show you some photographs because they're really disgusting. I mean, just think about, I don't know how many coal-fired power plants you have in Wisconsin, but if you do, the smoke goes up, it gets up into the stratosphere with all its mercury and everything, it goes to the Arctic, it comes down, it gets incorporated in seawater, the mercury gets incorporated by the phytoplankton, it works its way up the food chain, and as a result, fish and marine mammals don't reproduce or little, and they're sick and whatever. Here's a factoid for you. An Inuit woman who eats a traditional diet, breast milk would qualify as an EPA toxic waste dump. Okay? Wild salmon. I mean, I'm post-reproductive. I don't care. But any of you young people, you should care. I mean, wild salmon, when it dies in rivers in Alaska, is full of mercury. And then it gets into the food chain from the raccoons and the bears and the eagles and everything. And it just comes right back to us. You know, what you give, you get return. And if you knew it was in farmed salmon, you would not eat it. And so we get this, okay? And hold the thought of this charming set of pictures, because only about half of these died of mercury. The others died of the rise of slime, which we'll talk about. Next. So there are three manifestations of the rise of slime: dead zones in coastal seas, toxic algal blooms, and outbreaks of disease. And it's worth thinking about. I mean, and Lake Erie, I mean, it's the same thing, you know? Eutrophication. I just prefer saying rise of slime, but it's the same. So population explosions of phytoplankton. Why? Because of all the fertilizer that goes in the water, right? And overfishing. We kill the filter. And so what happens is the plankton don't get eaten, they sink to the bottom, they die, they rot microbially, the oxygen goes, and everything we value is gone. Kill the filter. This mountain of oyster shells was one of hundreds of mountains of oyster shells that surrounded the Chesapeake Bay at the end of the 19th century. Oysters, basically, for the scientists in the room, invented the millipore filter. They filtered clean the equivalent of the entire water in the largest estuary in the contiguous 48 states every few days. We killed the filter. And so we have dead zones. I started giving these talks in 2001 when I published a paper about overfishing. And at the time, there was an argument about whether there were 100 or 120 dead zones. In science, I think it was Science, not Nature, about 6 months ago, we now know we have way over 400 dead zones. And that's not just because we're looking more carefully. And dead zones are not dead. They are jellyfish and bacteria. They are pre-Cambrian ecosystems. And they are alive and well, and the fishery in dead zones is jellyfish that are sold to Taiwan and China. And jellyfish are crunchy, you know. This is an amazing picture. The Mississippi River Delta is here. The Texas-Mexico border is here. And this is a single toxic dinoflagellate bloom caused by that cute little creature with that wiggly tail. It can kill fish. And it can make you sick. And here's the picture that was in the front of the talk. I was in a, we did a thing called Hollywood Ocean Night to try and, you know, get celebrities to pay attention. And I was terrified, and I had to give this talk, and how do you relate to celebrities? So I said, imagine you're in a film called Escape from Malibu, which if you've ever been to LA, you know is a nice place. And everybody who can afford it has moved to North Dakota. And the only people left in Malibu are the street people who can't afford to buy a ticket because it's become so disgusting because the ocean is so sick. And my filmmaker buddy Randy Olson said, Jeremy, you've really, really lost it now. So this is Escape from Malibu, but it's in Florida. This is Carinia brevis, that same toxic dinoflagellate. It's coming ashore. We know this has always happened. We know from Ponce de Leon, we know that there were these things. They happen every decade or so. Now they happen all the time. And when it comes ashore and the breeze is blowing and the little water droplets get in the air, the hospitals fill with acute asthma cases. Sometimes they close the schools. And these dream homes of the people who had to live in New Jersey all their lives and move to Florida are not dream homes anymore. Cyanobacteria in Moreton Bay, same thing. Fisteria, oh, fisteria is delightful. Imagine 100 million fish decide to die at the same time, their guts explode, there's blood all over the place, caused by one of these pretty little creatures with a curly tail. And then coral disease. These two species built, they were the geological builders of the islands of the Caribbean for the last 2 to 3 million years. If you look at an island like Barbados, there's the old rocks, and then the whole top of Barbados is mostly elkhorn coral. These two species are now on the endangered species list. Right? That's like saying that all the forest, well, maybe they are, all the forest species are endangered species, as this sort of thing. And the reason is because of bleaching and everything, but also this disease, which is slime, right, microbial, and it kills this much a year. These are the fastest growing corals in the world. The one on the left can grow this much in a year, but the disease can kill this much in a year, which means the disease could kill its way all the way, I mean in a day, could kill its way across the room in a year. And so that's why they're on the endangered species list. Okay, climate change. We all know about this. It's even our former president knows about this. And it's doing so much I don't think we begin to understand. And one of the things I'm going to try and do is walk you through some scenarios at the end. Okay? But, okay, so I'm going to show you pictures of all this. The polar ice caps are melting. Summer sea ice, oh, it's not within the century. It'll be gone in 30 years. Entire ecosystems are trash. Species are not slowly moving, but galloping towards the poles. Coral reefs are disappearing. And the scariest thing in the whole business, acidification. Just think of it as Coca-Cola ocean. I mean, we're measuring the progressive decline in pH because CO2 dissolves in ocean water and forms carbonic acid and makes it really hard to be a clam or a snail. We'll talk about that. So when I first did these things, I used this picture, you know, just 14 years, and you know, I used to say, wow, the Northwest Passage is almost there. That's 2003. Now I have to use this uglier pictures because this is 2008. And the Northwest Passage has arrived. Think of the thousands of people who died trying to find the Northwest Passage boats alive and well. And in Panama, we had a big referendum, are we going to widen the canal? And we decided to do it, and it's going to cost us $20 billion. And we think it's good business because it's going to take 20 years for the insurance companies to figure out how to insure super tankers going through the Arctic. And so we'll make our money, and then, of course, everything will go this way. After that. You know, I don't think, I used to get in huge arguments at environmental board meetings about the polar bear ads. I don't think polar bears are going to go extinct. I think they're just going to be relegated to garbage dumps. And that picture is wonderful, right? But since there's almost nothing left to eat seals, seals are going to be like rats everywhere in the Arctic, and something's going to have to eat them, and polar bears are going to be very fat and very happy, but they'll glow in the dark because of all the mercury. You would not want to be in the water with this animal, although it tastes really good. And by the way, I do eat fish. I'd like to think that if we had some success, I could do it with a less guilty conscience. Humboldt squid used to occasionally make it to Southern California. They're now regularly fished off of Alaska. And you would not want to be in the water with 1,000 of those, because I guarantee you, you wouldn't get out. It's a major fishery. We have no idea what's going on. We have no idea how to manage it. But right now, everybody's very happy. And then coral bleaching. I mean, I think almost all of you know that a coral is a mutualism between the animal, the coral that makes the stony skeleton, and the little dinoflagellates that live inside. And so the coral protects the dinoflagellates and gives it nutrients, and the dinoflagellates feed junk food to the coral. And it's a very happy but mutually distrustful relationship. And when the temperature rises a little bit, then the algae, the symbionts, can't photosynthesize. They become dysfunctional. And so they don't give any sugar to the coral. And the coral says, boy, you didn't pay your rent. And so the coral kicks out the dinoflagellates. And you see, it looks beautiful. But that's like looking at a concentration camp. Because what you're looking at is corals that have lost all the symbionts that feed the coral. So do a thought experiment. You go camping on the 4th of July. And you wake up in the morning, and you look around you, and 80% of all the trees you can see have lost their leaves. And so you come back here, and you turn on the television, and you discover that 80% of all the trees in the entire continent of North America have dropped their leaves. And then, you know, a month later, you read on page 17 in the New York Times in an article this long, oh, by the way, a quarter of those died. Well, the Indian Ocean is about the same size as North America. And in 1998, during the big El Nino, 80% of all the corals in the Indian Ocean died, and a quarter of them bleached. And did you read about that? And then this is acidification. On the top, you see coccolithophores. Most people have never heard of coccolithophores. The white cliffs of Dover, the chalk, is made of the skeletons of these things. They are the most important primary producers in the food chain in polar and cold temperate seas. This is what they look like at normal pH, and this is what they look like when they're grown in experiments with realistically declining pHs. That, you know, all my colleagues, they measure this sort of thing regularly, and, you know, they croak. Okay, so let's have a little bit of hope. Coolest trip I ever went on, this is the Hawaiian Islands. This is the Northern Line Islands. And they were discovered only in the 18th century by Cook because, you know, if you're drifting around there, you're not going to find somebody to rescue like Mr. Wallace. So there was this natural experiment. There's an island with nobody. There's an island with 20 people. Gordon Moore bought it to protect it for $17 million and gave it to the Nature Conservancy. Then this is called Fanning Island by the U.S. military, and Kiritimati or Christmas Island, the second largest atoll in the world with 5,000 people. If you go diving at the place with no people, it looks like this. Now, I think that's beautiful. I don't quite know how you feel, but I mean, that's pretty close. It's far from pristine, but it's healthy. And you know, there's a few very big fish in the picture. The rest of the fish are neurotic, and they're down in the coral. And if you turn your camera towards the bottom, look what you see. Beautiful, living coral and pink coral and algae, which are essential for coral babies to grow. But wait a minute, what's wrong with this picture? This picture was taken in 2005. We all know global warming is a disaster that is making it impossible for corals to survive. We have all of this horrible doom and gloom data from around the world saying that corals are disappearing. They cannot survive climate change. So I guess these corals didn't read the papers, right? This is the island with 5,000 people. Notice the abundance of apex predators swimming around and the beautiful corals. But when Captain Cook discovered Christmas Island on Christmas Day, this is the description as the sailors rowed ashore. On every side of us, all these sharks, and they attacked them. They tried to get in the boat, to eat the guys rowing the boat, and tried to eat the rudder. And I've seen something a little like that, but I've never seen that, but I have no reason to disbelieve them, but that's what it looks like now. And yet most biological oceanographers, when we tried to publish these papers, said, it's obviously oceanography. This could not possibly be due to people. It's as if nobody was around, you know, to chronicle the disappearance of the passenger pigeon. So it was clearly due to climatic change that the passenger pigeon became extinct. And that's notice the lush, beautiful coral. And this is amazing because the entire Western Pacific has something like 20% live coral, but those uninhabited and protected islands have about 40% coral. So it's sort of different. So we asked, what do these uninhabited islands have in common? They have huge biomass of all this stuff, the fish and the sharks. They've got all this coral cover. In spite of the fact that the corals have bleached, there's been amazing bleaching, they've died, and all that, and yet there's still all this cover. In other words, they are resilient. The abundant algae for recruitment, and low incidence of disease, but they're totally different oceanographically. This is people. So that's really good news. To me, that's good news because it says protection actually works. If you do not kill fish and you do not kill them with mercury, there will be more fish. Now, we have spent about $25 million to demonstrate that because the fisheries industry said that, you know, we really need more data to know whether or not marine protected areas will actually make a difference. So they do. The corals and the protected reefs are more resilient. Global climate change will get them eventually. But if we protect the reefs from overfishing, if we protect the reefs from pollution, the corals can survive at least for a while. Of course, the bad news is that it only takes 5,000 people with rowboats to get rid of all those fish and make the change when that's all you have to do. So let's summarize all this stuff and then I'll try to quickly move on. Habitat change in the oceans is extreme. It's causing reductions in everything we love in the ocean. And it does not matter whether they're extinct or not because they're ecologically extinct. Because of that, we're getting all the things we don't want. The rats and cockroaches of the ocean. Those rays or whatever. And what's really, really troublesome, and this is the one area for which we really need strong, good science, is that once those new communities are established, it's incredibly difficult to reverse this situation. It's just like the Great Lakes, when we stopped polluting them, but they didn't get better, right? Until we did other stuff. And so you can see it in the picture. I mean, when I started diving on coral reefs, at least some of them, they looked like the left. If I take my students to the Caribbean, they can see that. And the question is, can we put Humpty Dumpty back together again? Okay, remember Rachel Carson? Second question, what are the projected long-term consequences of these changes? So I'm gonna make the assertion, and I get, you can imagine, especially at Scripps, I get in a lot of trouble for this. You know, it's the sort of we need more data syndrome. But we're really chickens. I mean, scientists are the worst. I mean, can you imagine walking into a meeting of the American Historical Society and saying people have profoundly changed the planet? They would say, tell me something. I mean, But scientists, you get a bunch of scientists in the room and you tell them people have profoundly changed the planet, and they'll say, show me your data. And you know, I mean, who are the people who stick their necks out and have some courage? There are people like this. I love this cover. Took me a while to find this cover. I particularly like, you know, I live south of LA, so I like a book to be read again and again and to ponder before oblivion comes. Los Angeles Times. And this is the way they advertised books in 1951. And we've got smoke and she's, you know, strapless dress out there and then whatever, but okay. So here you are. This is the rise of slime. This is the brave new ocean. I mean, this is a fact. There used to be a lot of big animals, and there aren't anymore. There used to be a lot of three-dimensional structure, and there isn't anymore. Coral reefs, kelp forests, mangroves, seagrasses, etc., sponge gardens. And we are about here. And I see no reason to believe that we're not going to be there. In other words, the global ocean will be a death zone. So here are my three scenarios. And think about how realistic you think these are as I go through them. Scenario one is the happy scenario. We cap and reduce nutrient runoff and carbon emissions, and we stop overfishing within the next 20 to 30 years, globally. If we do that, the oceans will actually still be mixed by upwelling, which means there will be oxygen on the seafloor, but it's certainly going to be too late for most megafauna. You saw the graph of the Alaskan pollock, and it's clearly all right managing by wishful thinking to go out and catch only, you know, we reduced by a few percent. So they're gone. But it'll be okay because mahi-mahi tastes good, and I personally really like sardines. Learn to like them. What if we fail to cap and significantly reduce carbon emissions? We fix all the other stuff, but we don't fix CO2. Well, think Black Sea. I mean, the oceans will become increasingly acidic. My colleague Andrew Dixon down the hall came and told me the other day, in the last 10 years, the pH of the global ocean has decreased by more than a tenth of a pH unit, and remember, that's a log scale. And then we'll be vertically stratified because the water will be too hot on the top, and it's hard to mix. We're already measuring a very significant decrease in upwelling. That means vertical mixing in the eastern Pacific, along in the California Current, the best studied upwelling system in the world. And there has been a corresponding decline in the productivity of what we want. So the oceans will become stratified. That means no oxygen down in deep water. Okay? And because it's going to be acidic, all the organisms like snails and clams and corals and the coccolithophores and whatever that require a particular pH to be able to calcify, they're not going to be there. I mean, so take your kids to the beach so they can see shells on the beach. Because sort of the implication of all this is there won't be any seashells on the beach. And then the third is business as usual. I should change that and call it business as usual. Or you could call it the last 8 years. So on top of all the horrible stuff I just described to you, we will also have unlimited growth of dead zones. And the dead zones will merge. They're starting to do that in some places. They'll just merge. And then the continents will be ringed by these dead zones. And think about aquaculture. I mean, if you eat something that comes from a dead zone, it's like gastronomic Russian roulette. Sometimes it'll be really good, and other times you'll die. So you probably wouldn't want to eat a fish that was raised in a dead zone. So, third question, I'm almost done. What can we do to stop all this? I mean, what we really have to do I think is beyond our comprehension. You know, in this country, we consume, depending on who you want to compare us with, 20 to 100 times more per capita than people in the rest of the world. How are we going to, now, let's say we're going to make it equal and everybody in the world has the same thing. How are we going to learn to be happy consuming 10% of what we consume? That's the task. Think about that as you go to your SUV, if any of you have them. Think about that if you haven't insulated your house. Think about that if you haven't thought about walking or taking the bus, because that's a big number, 80%, 90%. I mean, we could have a miracle, right? That's the wishful thinking school of management. We'll perfect fusion, and it won't be a problem, and we'll figure out how to vacuum up all that excess CO2, but anyway. So, we have to address those three drivers of degradation all at the same time. You know, if you waved your magic wand and made climate change go away, coral reefs would disappear in 20 years if we didn't solve the overfishing and the pollution problem. So we have to fix everything at the same time. And you know how good we are at doing that. And as I said, I mean, this requires fundamental changes in our entire ways of life, in fisheries, agriculture, industry. But, I mean, as a number of people pointed out, we can solve about 50% of the problem just by, you know, that amazing word, conservation. So these are the things I think we have to do. I mean, we have to make fishing ecologically responsible. That means, among other things, enforcing the law. The Magnuson-Stevens Fishery Act, as reenacted a year or two ago before Ted Stevens got thrown out of the Senate, he actually did. He's a very interesting political figure. He was not Darth Vader. He loved Alaska, and he believed he was right. I think he was wrong. But he cared so much, he worked very hard on a bill to try and manage our fisheries responsible. And that's a kind of goodness, right? So we have this law, we just don't obey the law. Sustainable wild fisheries on an industrial scale are an oxymoron, except for sardines and anchovies. I mean, when was the last time Western Europe relied on hunting and gathering to feed the population of England or France? It's a loser. We can always have, you know, as I said, I'm post-reproductive, and I really like Copper River wild salmon. And I don't care that it's got a little mercury in it. And I can afford, as a treat, to pay $40 a pound. And I'll probably eat it when it's $100 a pound. And actually, ironically, the fishers would be better off if they could just shift to poland line fishing and selling luxury products instead of being on the dole, which is where they are now. And the only alternative is aquaculture, and this is where conservation biology has really let us down, because farmed salmon is stupid. And everybody has been so obsessed with farmed salmon that they forgot that the Japanese have been raising seaweed for 5,000 years, and the French have been raising oysters for 1,000 years, and they do it very well, thank you very much. And it's very ecological, and it tastes good, and it's nourishing, and it's healthy. So we have to do aquaculture, but we have to emphasize things low in the food chain. And I gave this talk to a very friendly audience, and I saved this slide to the Seafood Summit, which was the industrial seafood industry of the world. So you can imagine how they liked this slide. Strictly enforce the law. By the law, pollock would be shut down. The most valuable wild fishery in the world would be shut down. And by the way, it's MSC, Marine Stewardship Council, certified by wishful thinking. The conservation community has the same problem that the resource management community has. None of us want to believe we screwed it up. Ban outright trawling, long lines, purse seining, gill nets. Do you know what long lines are like? lay a line from one end of the University of Wisconsin campus to the other end and go back and forth 25 times. Put 100,000 fish hooks on it and trail four of those behind your ship for 24 hours. That's long line. Okay. Very, 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 very large marine protected areas. God, W did that, right? And we should all be grateful. Of course, nobody lives there. It was easy. But don't underestimate the extraordinary importance of what they did. The Australians figured it out a long time ago. You know, they protected the Barrier Reef. It wasn't so protected. So what did they do? They said, you know, this isn't good enough. They spent 10 years in a political process, and under an administration, John Howard, who made Bush look sort of liberal, they decided to protect one-third of the entire Great Barrier Reef, including 20% of every habitat type in the Barrier Reef. That's the equivalent of saying we are going to protect one-third of the entire coast from the main Canada border to Key West. Can you imagine? Eliminate fishery subsidies, and this is relevant to what you people do around here. You make a lot of milk and cheese. And then regulate aquaculture to be ecologically sustainable, which means no more farmed tuna and salmon. Farmed salmon is you're raising cattle to feed to tigers to eat tiger steaks. And what you feed them is wild fish that you catch in the ocean, like trawling. Okay, agriculture. I wish I'd had time, I forgot to do it, to expand this slide for this audience. Because I do believe you are in the Mississippi drainage, right? So you are major contributors to the dead zone. And that's because of the Green Revolution. That's because of the invention of the process to make nitrogen fertilizer from natural gas. And it's also because we subsidize the overuse of that fertilizer, and we subsidize the overuse of the herbicides, and we deep plow. What you're losing, which is your greatest resource, is soil. The topsoil of the entire American prairie is running down the drain, down the sewer of the Mississippi River because of deep plowing. And if you accepted a 15% sort of reduction in your profitability, you wouldn't have that problem. So as far as I'm concerned, every time somebody buys fertilizer, it shouldn't be subsidized. You should pay $25 a 100 pounds as a tax. And then you'd think about how much fertilizer you use. And the same would be true of the pesticides. And the same goes for lawns and golf courses. And then the ultimate thing, which I don't know how much you have here, but I mean, if you've ever been to Northwest Arkansas or West Virginia or Central Pennsylvania and seen the chicken farms and the pig farms and the quantity of pig poop and chicken poop, which is unmovable and which is unregulated and goes down the drain. And then finally, capping carbon emissions. And I mean, this is just, I mean, I don't know how to do it. If anybody knows how to do it, tell us all, we'd be fascinated. But it means, I mean, I've been doing an experiment for 2 years. It's sort of a vision thing. I stopped driving 2 years ago. It is possible to commute to work in Southern California on the bus. I am living proof that you can do it, but I can tell you it takes creativity. I mean, if you've ever been to LA, just, I mean, think of that. And yet, we're the most environmental state in the country. We've got the most environmental governor in the country. That's scary. You know, you fly to Tokyo, there's 3 bullet trains an hour to Osaka. They're 80% full. They get there on schedule. They leave to the minute, probably to the second, but I don't have a watch good enough for that. Right? So, I mean, this is just... Okay, so what do we have to do? And think land, because I think that's what you all care about more than the oceans. I mean, we definitely have, I know this is a doom and gloom talk, but I mean, you gotta know the bad news before you can think about how you fix it. We've got to move beyond the doom and gloom and the refinement of the obituaries to actually do something. It's why I don't go to many conservation biology meetings, because they don't really do much. Right? We have to develop specific and testable management strategies, what the Australians did on the Great Barrier Reef. It is incredibly impressive. It's this thick to read, the management plan, by smart people. And we have to do that for everything at the same time. God, think of the jobs. I mean, hey, audience, young people, this is your future. And then we have to get tough. And that's hard to do in democracies, because we're as corrupt in democracies as in dictatorships. We're just not as good at ferreting out the corruption, which is why my retirement is worth $150,000 less than it was a year ago. And then, you know, it's an experiment. You screw up, it didn't work, do it again. So, I mean, I hope I've convinced you that the oceans are in a crisis. This isn't a tree-hugging little story. I don't think I used the word biodiversity once. It's very deliberate. I mean, I really deeply care about biodiversity. That's why I do what I do. But I've learned that if you want to talk to oil people, you don't talk about biodiversity. You talk about resources and human health and all that kind of stuff. And we're in trouble. And the whole Southwest, I mean, we could have the same talk about water. What is Phoenix, the fifth largest city in the United States, living on fossil water? And we have the ocean. We're already building our desalinization plants. I picture a future when we desalinate the Pacific and pump it in pipes to Phoenix at $100 a gallon for them to buy so that they can still have their golf courses. Now, I just love this quote, you know. I mean, and I like Rahm Emanuel. I don't know him. But I just figure he looks like he's tough, you know. And this is not original to him. I Googled it, and a lot of people have said it. But never allow a crisis to go to waste. That's the argument right now. That's why, you know, the different sides are ready to kill each other. Because this crisis is about opportunity and how we spend the money. So the question is to all of you, and Dan, I forgot to, yeah, it's there this time. Not just as scientists. I guess we have some significance. Managers have a little more. But in the old days of citizenship, you know, that was what it's about. So can we as people, as members of this country and others, respond to this challenge? And as you can tell from your computer, I think we can. Thank you very much.